Today on Lightning Bugs.
The creation of products that are more commercial in nature for Kush, things like that. For whatever reason, I feel incredibly lucky because in my life, everything seems to really have tightly dovetailed. And so the more I learn about creating a plugin or an analog piece of hardware and the insane level of detail that's required there, and managing the teams and the processes and stuff and pulling that together and pushing it out into the world, it's that last part, that pushing it out into the world, that I think is the hardest part as an artist. I have a tendency to, I think as many or most artists do, to just want to rework stuff indefinitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and part of that is, I know the common narrative is a lot of that is fear, and that is absolutely true. There is a lot of fear of just letting go, giving it over. This is your one shot to make an impression kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But for me also, like, I think a tremendous amount of it, and I don't hear enough people talking about this, I think, is just that some of us as artists are tweakers. We love the process of just getting in there and monkeying.
Yeah, you're going to miss that chapter.
New combinations of sound. Strip it down to the drums, change the tempo, build it back up again like a house of cards. You start to understand that there are these sort of building blocks. Everybody's got their own methods and approaches, but there are these sort of universal building blocks inside of these things. And if you figure out how to build each one and stack it and shape it your way and put it together, you can get a streamlined kind of a thing happening.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. Gregory Scott is a musician, inventor, songwriter, producer, educator of sorts. Actually, you could tag most of his skills with of sorts. That's a good thing. All the online resources I've come across to help me learn more about recording, mixing, and producing, I would say Gregory stands out. It's called Kush After Hours. It's not the usual pro tips on music production and mixing. It's about actual music, listening, hearing. His lessons put the responsibility on the student. What do you like? To know what you like, you have to learn how to hear, how to listen. And that's a skill that can take a lifetime, but it happens a lot quicker with a proper mentor. Gregory Scott often goes by UBK, Useless Bank of Knowledge. One of his projects is a company called Kush, which sells recording equipment or makes recording equipment, sells it off the back of a truck, of sorts. His designs, a shit ton of them. And then there are his audio plugins, more than you can shake a stick at. Gregory and Sarah Scott have a duo band called Sneaky Little Devil, which is probably where all the elements come together. So that's your intro. I was thinking about what you were just saying about what you're making and all the people moving parts. And one of the first things that came to mind was a episode of your YouTube where you say, here are all my creations. And then all of these pieces of hardware and software just fill the background with shit you created.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Does that feel incredible?
In this moment, I'm seeing it through your eyes, you know? So I'm getting that. In the back of my head, when I did that, I was actually a little sensitive to, is this too much around the office, what we call full pimp mode? You know, we try to shy away from that, you know? Because we're trying to keep it tasteful, and I don't want to shove anything down anybody's throat.
Keep it at half pimp.
That was my main concern. But you know, sort of flipping the lens around through your perspective, I appreciate that. Just like, you know, it took a decade to make that many products.
Yeah.
And I don't know. You asked about the feeling. I have very mixed feelings about Kush and business in general. I seem to have an affinity for writing and for skills and for making things appealing without like trying to sell them to people. And people like that. Yeah. So we try to keep it low key. But on the flip side, like I'm very sensitive to the downsides of capitalism, you know, sparking desires in people that maybe are artificial that they don't really have, or pitching products or services they don't actually really need for their spiritual and personal happiness. So we try to keep it really authentic, if that makes sense. It's weird to like try to make a business authentic, but that's always kind of been at the top of my mind is like, if I'm going to do this, it has to feel right in my bones. And if I'm going to put information in front of people, it has to have some value beyond trying to capture money from them. And I think that's where the YouTube show has really come into its own after like 10 or 12 years of being in business, of like really getting a good feeling, like I'm putting a lot of value in front of people and offering them something that's really meaningful to them. And then there's this other thing that they can do to support me if they want to support me or not. I don't care. I don't ever ask for it.
No, you don't.
I'm just lucky. Well, because I'm lucky. I'm really lucky that the company just kind of at this point is running itself in terms of, we don't have to do marketing. We don't have to do advertising. Once people know about us, enough of them adopt the products or subscribe to our products that it supports a living. So
yeah,
I don't really need more than that.
Well, and you know, like when if you play a gig, you get applause for the gig. There's nothing going full pimp about being like, finish the song, thank you very much, and taking a bow. Like that's fine, and it's I don't know of anyone who wouldn't think that was satisfying, except for when you really know you sucked and you're getting a big applause. Sometimes I've felt that before. But I mean, the things that, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast in the first place was I started realizing how many incredibly creative people there were that got no applause, didn't really have the benefit of making the living off of it. So that keeps you from having all the deadlines and all the things where you pull your hair out and then you look back and you see all your creations. Instead, you get off of work and you're selling insurance or something like that. And you get off work and then you make something in the couple of hours that you have that you still have a fucking brain. And there's no applause and there's no real recognition of it. And they don't have, unless you do it all the time, make stuff, you don't have you don't necessarily have templates and methods and ways to get out of ruts and ways to achieve things quickly and efficient systems, which everyone needs, even if you're just if you're writing songs or whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Do you think that you know, you're multi whatever it is you do, you're because you're one of just a few people who have the brain to do what you do. Do they support each other or do they fight each other? Like for instance, music. How do I say this? It's hard because that's a question that isn't normal. It's like you and George Massenberg and maybe just a few others that actually delve into both the creating of the tools and the using of the tools. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like your Vermeer and his paints or something like that. So really long way of asking, is one form of creation to you easier, more satisfying? Is there what are your thoughts of the way they tie in together?
Oof, wow, yeah, okay. The creation of products that are more commercial in nature for Kush, things like that. It's been a fascinating journey, but for whatever reason, I feel incredibly lucky because in my life, everything seems to really have tightly dovetailed. And so the more I learn about creating a plugin or an analog piece of hardware and the insane level of detail that's required there and managing the teams and the processes and stuff and pulling that together and pushing it out into the world. It's that last part, that pushing it out into the world, that I think is the hardest part as an artist. I have a tendency to, I think as many or most artists do, to just want to rework stuff indefinitely, you know? And part of that is, I know the common narrative is a lot of that is fear, and that is absolutely true. There is a lot of fear of just letting go, giving it over. This is your one shot to make an impression, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But for me also, like, I think a tremendous amount of it, and I don't hear enough people talking about this, I think, is just that some of us as artists are tweakers. We love the process of just getting in there and monkeying.
You're going to miss that chapter.
New combinations of sound. Strip it down to the drums, change the tempo, build it back up again like a house of cards. Like there's a, I think what's interesting about manufacturing and product development and song creation is that you start to, like you reference systems, you start to understand that there are these sort of building blocks.
Yep.
Everybody's got their own methods and approaches, but there are these sort of universal building blocks inside of these things. And if you figure out how to build each one and stack it and shape it your way and put it together, you can get a streamlined kind of a thing happening. I didn't invent manufacturing. I didn't invent any of the products that are made. These are just refinements on existing ideas. All of us are standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
And so if you just acknowledge that, like, I don't know how much I'm actually original or creative per se. I'm just doing something interesting that resonates with me. It'll resonate with others. And if I accept that, and that puts my ego in check, and then I'm like, then I'm free to study the masters, because everybody's figured this out already. Like, everything's already been done a million times, and oftentimes way better than I could ever do. So I just will get into, I study the designs of Neve and API, these old companies that have put together this amazing legacy gear. And I'm like, well, okay, that's how they did it in 1967. But like, how would I do it right now in a digital environment? And then on the musical side, like, Sarah and I just got done watching the Beatles Get Back documentary, Peter Jackson.
Insane.
I'm like, I don't know that we're ever going to get a shot again at seeing, it's basically like reality television in the late 60s.
Yeah.
In the studio with the Beatles of all. So like, whether or not you like the Beatles or even give a crap about them, studying the process, just looking at what these people have done and how they did it. Like, we've been writing songs together for like 7 years now, and we just like, we were taking notes, but we're just like, what, look at how he's, and it became a game for us to just be like, look at how like this music is coming through him versus coming through him. What's the difference? What's the process and everything?
Yeah.
We've already, just in the last week, we wrote a song in a week, which is unprecedented for us because we've adopted those techniques, you know?
A week is fast for you. For writing a song. When you say writing a song, do you think that the writing of it is being, it's on tape, or you're thinking, like, to me, that means the melody and the lyrics.
And that's what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about, like, we've got a basic musical skeleton, you know? And so the chord structure's in place, most of the arrangement, most of it, but not all of it. But the lyrics and the melody, that that came in together in under a week. It was really quite stunning for both of us, just to be like, okay. And we only got there because we studied the greats, but we also just, we ripped them off. We were like, this is what he's doing. Let's just copy that.
Yeah.
And it'll be, you can't help but express the way you express, but just, I don't know. Yeah.
It's a wormhole. You can't, you know, I think when you mentioned, sort of divesting your ego, that's the trick, because if you worry about, like, if you get into critic headspace and you're like, you're going to criticize yourself or someone else for not being original. Look, I've got two eyes and a nose. I put my hands down on the piano. The left hand seems to go to the bass. The right goes to, at what point, you know, despite the fact you've got the two eyes, and a nose and a mouth like most people, you still only look like you. Like, really, like, if you're really doing your job as an artist is just to simply create something that's honest in you. And you don't get that by thinking, has it been done? Am I doing it the wrong way? Did so-and-so do it this way? I've never seen anyone that, that's why so many crazy people are good at art. They don't ask questions like that.
That's one of the many reasons. Yeah.
One of the many reasons. Crazy. Yeah.
That's another thing, watching the Beatles, you just recognize, you're like, oh, we're all the same. We're all lunatics. We're like
hacks,
ragingly insecure and insanely arrogant at the same time, you know, all these contradictions inside of us. Because you have to be a little arrogant to think, I'm going to make this thing and put it in front of people and somebody's going to like it, damn it. You know, there's some hubris involved in that.
Probably easier to do once you've sold 60 million records.
I wouldn't know. I would love to know if that's true.
Yeah, well, I know, maybe it's harder. I don't know. I think I think you're right. I think the trip is probably pretty horizontal line that way, because things get easier as you get approval, and then things get harder as you get approval.
Yeah.
What I was blown away with watching the Beatles and everyone work was how professional they were.
Mm.
Because coming from kind of being a 90s, I'm from the 90s. I was born in the 60s, but
yeah,
you know, being like 90s guy, it was so uncool to be professional.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you were almost accused of like practicing singing in the mirror with a hairbrush or something if you just got something right. You know, and watching them want to get it right is awesome. I still need like another 20 years of therapy for people beating you up for trying to be professional and get it right. That was awesome to me.
Fascinating. Yeah, there just was so, it was just fascinating to get a glimpse into a different window of time. You know, everything was different then. Even sometimes when they were conversing with each other, I was really struck by how I had trouble understanding what they were communicating to each other. They understood each other very clearly.
Right.
Part of that was just being such a tight unit. But part of it also was just, it was 1969 and I was like, oh wait, people just talked differently then. And so the idioms and the structures of the words and the syntax and everything, sometimes I was just like, wait, what the hell are they talking about?
Here was the weird one to me. And Peter Sellers walked in and talking about a conversation that I had no idea the fuck they were talking about. Like, it looked like Peter Sellers was pretty much weirded out and left.
I think he was too high. I think my story is he got high with the Beatles, couldn't handle his high, and had to get the hell out of there. Because he had that paranoid, like, I can't process the words people are saying.
That's a good theory. I thought he got roped in just walking past. My theory was that everyone's nervous because it's just, you know, celebrity off. And that John Lennon decided just to be weirder than Peter Sellers, and he won. Even just watching, did it make you nervous? Like watching all that gear that now is really only seen as like avatars or whatever on people's plugins. See all that stuff get rolled in, tested while music is happening, and they're missing it. That was driving me nuts.
The gear, it's weird how like I almost didn't care about that. I would have thought I would have cared more about the equipment or anything, or just been fascinated what was going on there. But I was just so absorbed in the interpersonal dynamics that I almost didn't notice there was recording happening.
Oh, that's really cool. So you weren't like looking at Glenn John's, drum recording technique and stuff, which
there was one moment when I was just like, ah, fuck, I wish the camera would pull back because I want to see how Ringo's kit is mic'd in this moment, because they kept changing the setups and everything, you know.
Yeah.
It was at Apple Studio and there was just such an amazing dry crunchy splat on his snare, and I was like, ha, where are the microphones, what are the microphones and where are they? And eventually I was like, oh, there it is, interesting. So yeah, I got a little geeky at one point, but for the most part, no, I was just enjoying the drama.
Well, I only did probably at the point where they were all really concerned about what it is they were hearing. And you're looking at all these really odd-looking Vox monitor speakers pointed all over the place in the room.
Yeah.
And in this era where everything is a separate track, everyone's on the headphones and stuff, to watch them just splattering sound all around the studio and who gives a shit was...
Yeah.
Was, I think that was the one lesson people should probably get out of it. Look what we've done with our headphones. Like, who wants to record with those on?
I don't use them. I got an episode talking about that on the After Hours show, and
I missed that one. I'll clock in on that one.
Yeah, I think it's sandwiched in there when I'm talking about like cheap microphones versus expensive microphones. And
oh yeah.
But for me, like as a singer, headphones just, I can't hear my pitch at all. I'm not a very good singer in terms of pitch to begin with. And when I put headphones on, it's just out the window. I'm so out of key and I can't hear it. I don't know that I am.
No, I know. There's something about, I don't know what it is. You know, someone could explain it to us, but there is especially a certain kind of person. Their brain doesn't process. Our brains don't process what we're hearing in headphones in a way that gives you the normal feedback loop that you need to keep in tune. No one sings, a neurologist will tell you, no one sings the first few milliseconds of anything actually in tune. And our feedback system really quickly kicks in and you bring it up or down to the center that you need. But something about headphones, I'm like, you know, it reminds me of like, and I've got a piano tuner in here, so maybe that's why. The piano tuner's listening to pitch, and they're not listening to pitch, they're listening to beats. They're listening to they're listening to beats in unisons and fifths and fourths and stuff. And we're listening to the sonority of it. We're listening to what, oh, that's a fourth. That's a major third. That makes me happy. But you're not listening to the beats. I think the putting the headphones on somehow for some people, because I've noticed a lot of musicians and singers are awesome with it. They just put them on and they're fine. And some of us just don't. And I have to think it's like you could do a brain scan and find out, but I can't do it. You know, the opportunities of talking to someone who is so microscope, zoom out, helicopter, zoom in, microscope.
That's the hardest part. That's the hardest part, man.
That's what drives me. That's what makes my nervous system crash.
Yeah.
That'll do it.
Like, this is fucking hard.
Yeah, but this is what you do. Like, so when you're making a song and you're making music, are you like a doctor that's like having dinner and thinking about the amino acids or something? Like, how does this manifest in things which are a challenge while you're making music?
Oh God, yeah. I am. Twyla Tharp, you know Twyla Tharp?
Yeah, dancer, right?
The dancer, yeah. She wrote a book, an amazing book. I recommend it to anybody who's an artist or just finds artistry interesting. She talked about how, in her opinion, there's two categories of artists you can put every artist into. Mm. There's the kind whose focus is close and the kind whose focus is pulled back. Right. And she's like, if you know which type you are and you just learn to leverage it, you'll be fine.
Mm.
And I really appreciated that because I am absolutely zoomed in with a microscope type of person, artist, all of that. So
but your teaching is not, which is interesting.
Right.
Your persona that I know has the ability to be super helicopter.
I'm working on that. Thanks. Yeah, because that's the hard, I think that's the harder and more necessary of the skills for music and music production. Like if you write a song and produce a song and you do the recording, if you're the everything all hats person, and you have a pulled out focus, you may miss some of the critical details and the nuance and everything, but by and large, you stand a better chance of making something that's going to resonate than if you're somebody who's all the way in, can't see the big picture ever, and just are, you're looking at it like this the whole time and you put it together and it's done.
Yeah.
You're not even going to be able to hear what you've actually done. And it's not going to resonate with as many people, I think, because the magic generally happens on the big picture, the full composite, because most people aren't trained artists. They're not trained listeners. They're not OCD geeks, you know? So they just, when they listen to a song, the average listener hears the melody.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe they hear some of the lyrics. If you play a song for the typical person and then hit stop and be like, what was the drum beat?
No idea.
What were the guitars doing? They don't.
Yeah.
They don't know. And they don't care because it doesn't matter. It's all about communicating a feeling specifically. So if you can just, if you got a vibe, if you can make the listener feel something, you've got magic there. And that requires the big, but you have to understand how it's all coming together into a single state.
Well, certainly someone does, you know, which is why I always come back. I mean, I constantly think, because there's amazing things about now. I mean, think about what we've got at our fingertips, but it does require everyone to be everything. And, you know, like, I don't know, I've got this really great photograph behind me of Frank Sinatra and Capitol Records. And every once in a while, I start to realize, oh shit, that's Nelson Riddle right back there in the background. And then I guess around the corners, I don't know, a name like Al Schmidt comes to mind. I don't know who was doing the engineering, but like all these brilliant people, but they were just focused on small things. And even, you know, even Frank was probably focusing on what he thought was the big picture. But really, it came down to things like he was thinking about his vowels and what his suit looked like and, you know, how he said the word heart. Did it sound right?
Yeah, he was granular as fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was definitely zoomed in. But he did also have the ability to just sort of know when things were working and when they weren't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that, even if that's all you know, right, that is the most valuable piece of information. And so you just like, I hit play on a song that's complete but needs to be mixed. And I know what's not working. I know that it's not working.
Yeah.
And then I have to find it, you know? And so trial and error is a huge part of my process. Huge. I don't generally have a vision going into things.
Do you have that that phenomena where if you're going, I've only learned this over the last year, because when I hit bounce, because I'm going to send it to Leo to listen to, as soon as I hit bounce and the music starts, within 2 seconds, I know everything that's wrong with the mix. I had no mm-hmm. idea what was wrong with the mix prior to bounce. You have any?
Yeah.
Well, that's weird.
The closest thing that I know about that's like scientifically demonstrated is something called limbic resonance.
Okay.
I don't know if you've heard of this.
Limbic
but
resonance.
Like, I think most of the world is limbic right
yeah.
now. Limbic is just, it's just the fight or flight or the or the freeze. And it has the ability, out of necessity, evolutionary necessity, to shut down as much or as little as it thinks it needs to in an instant, this part of the brain, right?
Right.
So if it decides there's a threat, you can't be analyzing shit.
Right.
You just got to act. And so the limbic system is actually a filter in addition to a control center. And so if the limbic system decides I need to take control over things, it will hold back information from you. Anyway, limbic resonance is this phenomenon where human beings that are in proximity to each other are able to see each other
mm-hmm.
and hear our tone of voice and assess body language and all the subconscious cues and the conscious cues. The limbic systems of all the different brains in that space will begin to fire in sync with one another. Oh. And somehow I think that's related to this ability that we all have and which you're talking about, which we experience as music producers or whatever. You've written something, you got it recorded, and then you're like, yeah, let me play it for somebody. And they come in, they don't have to say a thing. You thought you knew what was what, and then you play it for them, and right away you're like, that's wrong, that's horrible, why did I do, you know what I mean? You just like, you hear everything through their ears.
Yeah.
And that does seem to extend even to when you're practiced enough. Like you said, when you hit that bounce button, you project, you immediately start to hear it through the ears of the person that you project is going to be listening to it.
Mm.
And then it's all, your filters all, everything changes.
It is oddly kind of empathetic, and it also kind of hits a point that I think is artists have to figure out how they're going to answer their interview question. Do you make music for yourself or do you make it for other people? Because you want to say as an artist, nah, man, I just make it for myself. I don't give a shit what anyone else thinks. And then I'm not sure that I know anyone that is that psychopathic. I think we do make it for other people. And the point is more that you didn't change something that you knew was good.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. Empathy. I think because those are all, I think, facets of the same diamond, you know, that resonance that we have, that ability to lock in with each other.
How then, since we're on brains, armchair pseudoscience, just talking about brains. What about this phenomena that is something that's always bothered me, which is people liking to A, B equipment. And if I'm in the studio and they're like, let's do a shootout and let's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, these microphones. I don't listen. I can't hear them. I don't hear them at all. If I listen to one set of speakers and listen to another, it's, you know, I got to get like 10 minutes before I'm not dizzy anymore. Like I don't hear it that way. So when people want to say which microphone is better and you're listening to them both, I have no idea.
Interesting.
What I'm hearing. Do you have any words of wisdom about AB and then ABCDing and EFGing and all that shit?
Try to keep it to AB if you can.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you get into three choices or more, we get lost.
Yeah.
AB, you can do on instinct. ABC, you start to get analytical. And I think it's critical to stay instinctive. It's like I'm talking to you right now through a 50s German microphone, vintage tube. It's got a big warm, woolly sound. And it picks up, if you crank the gain on the preamp, it picks up like, you know, a needle falling across the room. But we don't use that to record our vocals. We use a $85 beat up handheld microphone.
Yeah, that looked pretty cool. I remember that episode. I didn't even know what that mic was, but it's some kind of little dynamic which you could drive nails with.
Yeah, pretty much. And people have by the looks of it. It's like 60 years old. And, you know, we did an A-B of that too, but mostly that was about workflow for us because you can hold it in your hands. You can walk around the room. You can have the music playing in the speakers. And so you can give an actual legitimate performance without headphones and you can feel it. But in terms of like the question of how comparing gear and everything, I think my best advice on that for anyone is try to do it as quickly as possible using your instinct.
Right.
You know everything you need to know in 3 to 5 seconds. Switch over to the other one, 3 to 5 seconds. Hit stop. Which one?
Yeah.
If you don't know, based on that information, it probably doesn't matter.
Beautiful. That's true.
And that's where you just flip a coin, or which one makes your life easier, which one's less expensive, or which one can you work the way you want to work, you know, like whatever, some other analysis than the sound, because, you know, the sound is rarely what matters to anybody other than us.
Well, we are in an era, though, where I think about records that I even in my life that I worked on, and they're just full of the wrong answer. Like, what I mean is, like, they're just full of wrong choices all over the place. And, you know, and it's fine. Like, I think they sound cool, but, like, I feel like that we're living through an era of these right and wrong choices. Like, this is the better one, and this is the way to do that, and this needs to have this amount of low end. I think some of it's like, I was trying to learn how to use my home computer during lockdown to do the things I needed to do. You go to forums and you read all these people talking about what's better than what and what the right thing is to do. And it does instill a certain amount of fear, even into someone's head who, like, I've done it forever. And suddenly I'm thinking, oh shit, I don't want to make the wrong choice. Like, I've got 3 mics. What's the right choice? Up? It's like, I guess all of them are the right choice as long as I sing well, you know?
Yeah, that's really, like, now we're starting to talk about just an approach to life in general.
That's true.
Right? I try very much to keep the analysis simple and doable. There's a Japanese principle called Kaizen, which is the smallest possible change that you can do right now with the least amount of effort.
Mm.
And so you just do that. If you're constantly doing the least amount, small thing, you don't overwhelm your nervous system.
Yeah.
You make clearer, better choices. They're incremental, and you sort of chip away at whatever the problem or the process is. And eventually you'll find, suddenly you'll be like, oh, wait, I'm there. I did it.
Yeah.
But I think for me, the analysis, it's never what's the best or what's the right. It's just, is this a good choice? Is this a strong choice? Am I making a good choice here? Am I making the situation better? So if I'm getting a new piece of gear, is it just better in some way than the one I'm replacing with? Do I even need it in the first place? Am I distracting myself?
That, I think, is the maybe that's more what I'm feeling than anything, is the number of choices and how much of its own, how much of its own activity that can be, just fucking around. That's why I never really liked synthesizer and keyboards and stuff with 10,000 options and presets. I love that I sit down at a piano and that's, we done. Like,
you get what you get. Yeah.
But when I sit down at a keyboard, I go, doing, doing, geek, geek, wah, bah, 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 and I go through shit and I just like I'm drooling and I'm doing this for so long and nothing gets done.
Yeah.
I don't record anything. I don't get anything done that way. I have to have, certain choices have to be made or I'll lose faith in my choice.
Yeah. Yeah, because you lose perspective. That's like that's the death of everything creative, is loss of perspective. You don't know. I've been working on a mix for so long, I realize I'm like, wait a minute. I literally can't hear what I'm doing anymore. I mean, like,
yeah.
I know, like, I've made the kick drum louder, but I have no idea if it's better or worse.
That's right.
And then you just have to walk away. You have to step away.
Yeah.
And step out of nature, get a brain reset.
Man.
Go to dinner.
I got my, you do. You have to get away from it. I got my, I'd never really listened to them. They were just in my studio for 15 years. I was touring and other people were using them, but I had a pair of Auratones. And I just plugged those back in last week, and I love them. Fucking love those speakers. Those are great. Suddenly I could hear all the things that I thought I was hearing before. I heard it all. I heard where the snare and the voice sounded like they were in the same or not in the same room and all this kind of stuff. The reverb tails is awesome. I love those speakers. We made, my band made our second record in a very small house. It was like 500 square feet house. There's no room at all. And we were monitoring on this Macintosh stereo amplifier, which we had fucking cranked in the kitchen as our playback. And it was compressing insanely. And we recorded and responded to everything through that lens. And we took it up to a very fine mixer, Andy Wallace, and heard it come out of the speakers. We're like, nah. And that's not what we recorded. That's not what we recorded at all. We didn't really understand. I didn't understand until years later why, what I had done to myself. And probably the way to have gotten back to that might have been to just go ahead and squash the whole the whole thing and like bring us back to that original feeling.
Bring in the tubes.
Yeah. I've been fairly unfocused because I just love talking to you. And I keep forgetting that we have a mission. So then I know that's the way podcasts are, but the whole thing, there's two things that we want to do here to wrap this up, because one time we ought to just hang out instead. But I want to get an exercise, and since you're kind of a teacher, this shouldn't be too tough. What we're calling New Week's Resolution, which is, it's just, this week I will do this thing regularly. Like, it could be read poetry every day. It could be run through a field blindfold, whatever, you know, something that you imagine would help people with their creativity, not just to get you out of a rut, but just to get you in a different mind frame to help you.
Oh, wait, so I'm coming up with an assignment for the listeners or
for
myself?
Yeah, that's correct. No, you're coming, well, it can be for yourself, but the idea is you're the boss of us for a week, and you think that everyone should, you know, go to an art museum. That was one of them. Chris Thiele said, just go to a museum. That's enough for me.
I would say copy something as precisely and accurately and thoroughly as you can. So if you're a musician, pick a song that you love, or even one that you don't, but you think is interesting, or that has some sort of a quality that you wish you had more of, or whatever, and clone it. No interpretation, no putting your spin on it. Like, if the singer's making a tone of voice, try to cop that tone of voice. If the guitar has an effect on it, try to cop like everything. Or if you're a visual artist, you know, just draw or paint or do a scene from a movie, like whatever.
That's beautiful. I love that. Yeah. So if you're, whatever it is that you do, whatever your discipline, Professor Scott says,
if you're a writer,
copy for the week.
Rewrite, just type out the chapter of a book. Just there's something about, or write it by hand even, you know, it might even be better. Just like, just copy it.
And that brings up two quick things, which is the reason I've remained unfocused in our conversations. It just makes me think of these things. One is how hard I had to fight for Weird Al Yankovic to do one of my videos with the label, because they didn't see him as somehow relevant in that year, as a relevant artist or video maker. And what they weren't understanding is, if a cat has copied every major video to the T for 25 years, he can do it. And that actually bore out to be true. I've never worked with someone who is as accurate, ahead of time, under budget, said exactly, his treatment was 20 pages long as opposed to your normal 2 pages, storyboarded everything out. There was no improv of anything, and it was perfect. I loved it. I would love working that way. That makes me think of that. What you're saying. The other thing is, did you ever hear the Bad Hemingway contest?
No.
It was a contest for years. It may still go on, where people submit their bad Hemingway, like write like Hemingway, but do it badly.
Okay.
I mean, maybe that should be a.
I love it.
That should be a thing. Let's get some. So just to sum that up. What Gregory's saying is whatever your discipline is, even if it's, you know, if you're a barber, or, you know, whatever it is you're doing, you're going to spend the week concentrating on copying something great.
Yeah.
Love that.
Because you'll learn. You'll just learn.
All right. Well, let's get a question or two from the listeners.
Hi. So I was curious if you think different signs have different creative workflows, or how you think collaboration between compatible signs could be beneficial. Thank you.
I guess it first depends on what you make of that. If you mean astrological signs, I read a little bit about mine years ago, and the Virgo is the asshole sign. So I didn't find it flattering. So
a little anal.
Yeah, I didn't. It wasn't flattering to me, so I decided not to believe in it.
That's not me.
Yeah, I've never done that before ever. What about you? How do you see that?
I guess just being honest, I've never thought about things in those terms. But I think sometimes I try to hear the question behind the question.
And thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I the way that I would interpret this question, which is, I maybe owe the listener an apology because he probably literally just means the signs. But I think paying attention to the workflow needs of each person on a team is critical. And part of that, maybe the biggest part of that, is understanding how the other human or humans communicate, how they express information, and how they receive it. And because it's really hard to get a meeting of the minds with other humans, and it's magical when you do, but you can facilitate that if you are respectful of and make an attempt to learn or pay attention to how other people work. Some people like to have lists and plan it out, and other people are just like, let's just get to it and it'll be what it'll be. And so if you've got those kinds of people that you're working with, you got to find a way to like make it work. And in communication, some people communicate in abstract and language of feelings and emotions, and they literally will say things like, I just, it doesn't feel right. And somebody else is like, oh, that frequency is bothering me at 4K, you know? And so then you have to bridge those gaps and figure out how to make the communication work there. I'm not a fan of compromise, if that makes sense. I think that meeting in the middle is the death of everything and everyone. And so instead, what Sarah and I have adopted, we got from, I think I read it in an interview with Daniel Lanois once upon a time, talking about his collaborations and how the rule in the studio with him is that every idea has to be pursued with good faith. No matter how stupid you think it is, no matter how inane the suggestion, if the drummer's like, I want to try this 5 BPM slower, you have to try it and you have to give it your all, because what happens is, in a creative space, if you argue ideas, they're endless and they create distrust and they just kill it. They just kill the space.
That's brilliant. That's
and
huge.
On the flip side, my experience with Sarah and any artist that we've worked with is that if you try the idea and then you have something that you can all look at, you have a thing that you can look at or listen to or objectively evaluate, you all agree whether it works or it doesn't. There is never any arguing over whether the thing is actually working. The idea, whether it will work, is an endless battle. Whether it did work, everybody knows it. It's just, that's our experience. And so
it's a little like what they teach in improv class, which is yes and.
Yes and. Yeah.
You know, I think that's useful. I love that the whole room will understand, you know, what it is. I suffered that for the whole time I played in a band. And it made me a little bit of a dick, because I would cut ideas short. Like I said, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. That's not a good idea. And then I started, collaborating in my solo career with people whose records were legendary to me. And I loved them, and they would have bad ideas, and they bring their bad ideas in. And I wasn't about to tell that person that they had a shitty idea. I had to see it through to show them that it was a shitty idea. And half the time it was great ideas. And half the time it was shitty ideas. And it was so much faster. So much faster.
It saves so much time. It's faster and it's better. It's easier. It's simpler. And you just, it connects you all when you, everybody gets their due. The flip side of that coin, this is where the ego check comes into play, is that I had, once we got into the all idea, we try all the ideas, is that about half the time, what I thought was the greatest frickin' idea on the planet was garbage. I'd be like, no, you need to synchronize. And then we'd listen back and I'd be like, oh, Jesus, stop it. That's horrible. Let's move on. And so it gets you past yourself, because you just, it's humbling to recognize, like, well, about half my ideas suck hard on a good day.
That's right.
You know? So.
Yeah. We're supposed to, I think that's part of what I was thinking when I was saying we live in the era of right, too many rights and wrongs. There's too much purity and right and wrong about things. There's a right mic choice. There's a right choice of all these things. And back to the Beatles, watching the Beatles work, they were very well aware that they were throwing out ideas that might just suck. And there was a real fearlessness about it, which is awesome. Even Ringo sitting down, I'd like to be under the sea. You guys think that's a good idea? And they're like, yeah, let's keep going with that. That actually kind of moved me. I was like, these are great people too. Like, that's just so cool.
I had a similar experience with that moment when he just had a little song snippet of an idea. And without hesitation, George just came over and started helping him to, like,
that's right.
We can take this farther, maybe try this or do that and everything. And
No, that's good. We all need to learn from that. Well, take care of yourself and hope to see you out there in some form doing a thing or something like that.
Yeah, likewise, man. Stay safe and stay healthy. Thanks so much for all of this.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.